Welcome to Banfield. At just 7 years old, Harmony Montgomery should be fast asleep in her bed right now, perhaps dreaming about recess and classmates and walking to school tomorrow. Instead, both her mom and dad say they have no idea where she is, and her dad won't even talk to the police about it. It is a far cry from parents who would claw their way through a mountain the minute they realized their child was missing. But Harmony has been gone for more than 2 years, and police have only known about that for 2 weeks. Now we're learning more about the relationship between mom and dad before Harmony disappeared. And perhaps it's no surprise, mom says it was pretty violent. More on that in a moment. Already, there have been two arrested in connection with Harmony's case. Her dad, Adam Montgomery, he was picked up in a car, sleeping with a girlfriend, and he was charged with second-degree assault, interference with custody, and endangering the welfare of a child. And Harmony's stepmom, Kayla Montgomery, she was charged with welfare fraud because police say she continued to collect food stamps for little Harmony, even though the girl was no longer in the home for quite some time. Crystal Sorry is the biological mom. She says she thought Harmony was with the father all this time, but didn't see her own daughter for almost 2.5 years. News Nation's Brian Enten has had a one-on-one interview with Harmony's mom, and he joins me now live. So, Brian, you know, this is so distressing for so many people, this story. And I'm going to get to the whole question about how does mom go for 2.5 years without laying eyes on her daughter? But that is just a moment from now. First, let's get to this latest evidence. The police actually sending response teams in to search that house where Harmony was last seen. Evidence of like hot water pipes to warm up the earth. Explain what happened there.
Yeah, I've never seen anything like this, Ashley. This search has been going on at this house behind me for the last 3 days. We learned through a source that it started with cadaver dogs. They brought cadaver dogs to the house. Harmony's last known address from 2 years ago searched. We're not happy or satisfied with how that turned out. So then they brought in sonar, searched the entire backyard. It was all totally frozen because it is so cold right now in New Hampshire. And this part was really interesting. They ran hoses with hot water all over the backyard for almost 24 hours to thaw out the ground, covered it with tarps, and then started digging at 6 this morning, the FBI evidence team, in certain parts of the backyard. There were signs that they may have found something, but just within the last couple of hours, within the last couple of hours, Ashley, we learned that they found nothing. Crystal, Harmony's mom, confirmed to me that she got a call from police that this search came up with nothing.
And this is now the FBI. They're sending in sort of the big guns, the feds, to help out with the locals in figuring out what could possibly be going on at that house and that yard. But Brian, as for mom, Crystal, sorry, a lot of people just cannot get their heads wrapped around the idea of not seeing your own child for 2.5 years and then starting to raise red flags. So what does she think about this search in the backyard, in the home? Does she have any thoughts on what's going on?
She 100% from the first moment I started talking to her said she thinks it's basically a waste of time. She fully believes in her heart that her 7-year-old daughter Harmony is alive. And she fully believes that her ex, Harmony's dad, Adam, sold Harmony. You have to understand, Adam, major criminal history, deep into drugs and addiction. She believes that he hit a point where he sold Harmony to make money to buy drugs.
I mean, that to me is just such a hideous statement in all of this. But there's the bigger question. And this is the question everybody wants to know about this story. It doesn't matter what she thinks about what he might have done. How does a mom go for 2.5 years without laying eyes on her daughter? I mean, I'd be breaking windows at the police station. I'd be clawing my way, like I said, through a mountain to just lay eyes on my child. What is her answer to that?
That is absolutely the number one question. And you have to understand, Ashley, these are all people that surround this entire situation who have been deep into drug use and addiction. The mother, Crystal, is now in recovery, but she says when her daughter first went missing, she was still deep into drugs. her daughter was taken away from her. She still does not really understand how the father was able to get custody, because he had a very, very violent past and had been under investigation for abuse complaints. And she says even to this day, she can't figure it out. I want you to listen to what she told me.
I had called right after he stopped talking to me, but I was talking to my therapist, and I was telling her, like, listen, this is affecting my mental health. I can't sleep. I'm super depressed. Like, you know, my son's well taken care of, but me personally, I was really sad, you know, like something right here all the time, just telling me, like, you got to get her, you got to get her, you know. And I said to my therapist, I said, no one's hearing me. I've made reports. I've talked to desk people at DCF office because I didn't have a certain extension because Demetrius wasn't on the case anymore, which was the person that was supposed to remove her that didn't. He knew Adam personally. He was Adam's DYS counselor. So he was a conflict of interest from the beginning. So the three times they were supposed to remove her, they didn't, because he knew him personally. And then I got word when Mauricio had reached out to me and said, you know, I was told you had made past reports, and then they started asking me questions about Harmony, and I said, I still haven't seen or heard from her, nothing, and didn't hear anything. The guy was I have all the text messages from the guy basically doing nothing. So I reached out to the mayor, and I said, listen, if you guys don't help me find my daughter, because DCYF and DCF and Mass dropped the ball on this one, let her slip through the cracks. I said, I'm going straight to the media. I don't care. It was like hours later, I got a phone call from the police in Manchester. And I had already called the Manchester police. They told me I couldn't file a missing persons report because he had physical custody of her. So they said, like, they told me, go to court and file a petition to get custody. So I go there, and they tell me if it's a DCYF open case, then I can't go there and go to court. So they were running, like, sent me around for busy work, you know what I mean, while they were trying to figure out how to cover their butt.
Now, so you heard that, Ashley. There are so many moving parts. And according to the mother, Crystal, she says she tried. In the beginning, she thought that perhaps her ex was just keeping Harmony from her. When she actually grew concerned, she says she called DCF. She called the police, but she says she got nowhere until she finally emailed the mayor of Manchester and threatened to go to the media.
All of that runaround business makes perfect sense. For our viewers who are frustrated with government bureaucracy, they get it. It is hell. However, 2.5 years is beyond the pale. I don't think you deal with bureaucracy for 2.5 years while you're trying to see. Just lay eyes on your daughter. I don't know. I just have a really tough time believing it's just all bureaucracy. That said, I get it. The addiction problems at the beginning, that would have set, you know, things back a long time. And then there was the story that she talked about, the abuse that she suffered at the hands of Adam, saying that he would choke her while she was pregnant. Can you elaborate a little more on that, Brian?
Yeah, one of my top questions for Crystal today was, did you know Adam to be violent? And she immediately answered yes, without hesitation. She says that Adam would choke her when she was pregnant over and over again. Anytime that he would get upset with her, he would literally choke her. And then we also know through the police reports that very sadly, he is accused of abusing poor little Harmony. She had a black eye. She apparently just had an awful, awful life in this house behind me. They were basically squatting here, Ashley. They didn't even have power or utilities, we learned today.
I mean, that just depresses me to no end to think that little girl. I want to play just a piece of that interview that you did with Crystal Story, because a lot of people think, how on earth would that guy get custody of a little girl? I get it. Crystal had her problems, but that guy. So have a listen to this.
I still don't understand to this day. I had a court date on the same day of that hearing for Jameson's adoption. So I sent over to get a continuance from the courthouse saying, hey, we need a different court date. I can't cut myself in half. they denied my continuance and just handed him over custody because they wanted to wash their hands of the case. You know, they were done with it. It was for, the lady said it was open 4 years too long.
So basically she says that she still doesn't understand exactly how he got custody. We have reached out to the state, to the Department of Children and Families here in New Hampshire, also in Massachusetts. They were involved at one point. They are not commenting. This is all still very much under investigation. How the heck does a man like this, with such a history and ongoing drug use and squatting in a house behind me, end up getting to keep a 7-year-old little girl?
Well, it's sad to hear her say that she thinks that the fact that she adopted Harmony's little brother out to a couple in Washington, D.C. now, who we've spoken with, she believes that that may have given Adam the idea to sell Harmony. Is that really her story? She thinks that because the person who adopted Jameson was a public figure, a television anchor, and there was a TV story about it, that at the same time there was television coverage of it, she believes that that's when Harmony may have disappeared and may have been sold to, say, another couple looking to adopt a child?
Yes, that is her working theory. She thinks that that Adam, the dad, saw a part of that adoption ceremony on TV, recognized his son, and thought, you know what? Maybe I want drugs so badly, and I will do anything to get my hands on these drugs. And frankly, I'm such a terrible person, according to her, that she thinks in his deranged mind, he thought, let me try to sell Harmony on my own into some kind of situation, and I can get rid of her that way, too. She says that Adam didn't even like Harmony, that Harmony bothered Adam from the very, very beginning. I mean, it was disturbing to hear all of this today. And you mentioned it earlier, Ashley. As I'm having this conversation, I'm thinking to myself, how did you not get your daughter out of this situation somehow? Look, I know you tried, but how did you not find a way? Do you feel bad about that? Listen to what she told me.
I played a part in this. I'm not going to sit here and act like I'm innocent. Like, I'm a recovering addict. Like, when I gave birth to her, I didn't know nothing about being a parent. I didn't know nothing about getting in recovery. But I never stopped trying. I always went into program after program after program trying to, you know, prove to her and my family that I wasn't going to stop until I got better, you know. And I just, you know, especially when I kept reaching out to Adam, kept reaching out. Like, I even wanted to show him, like, look how far I've come, you know. Yeah, there's a lot of shame and guilt, you know, that come with this. But it's not gonna set me back. It's gonna motivate me to keep fighting for her and keep looking for her, because if I can't speak for her, who else is going to?
I tag out of it. Quickly, Brian, I was just listening to the emotion in her voice, but at the same time, I wonder if she is a suspect in any of this. Do we have any idea if the police are clearing her or if she is still of interest in this missing child?
They are not telling us anything, which is something interesting here. They had a press conference last week. They have not answered one question from the media for the last 3 or 4 days. So we don't know that based on police. But we have no reason to believe at this point that she's a suspect. She was at the courthouse today at a hearing involving this entire situation, and she appears to be cooperating fully.
Brian Enten, you've done just a terrific job in getting that interview. We're going to stay on this story, and hopefully there'll be some developments, hopefully positive ones. But what a tragedy. And obviously the opioid epidemic in that community has been, it's been crippling. So I thank you for your work.
Thanks, Ashley.
Brian Enten live for us tonight up in New Hampshire. I want to turn now to another missing person story that we've been following very closely. 24-year-old Daniel Robinson, you'll remember he is that young geologist who was working in Buckeye, Arizona when he disappeared June last year. His coworker said that he showed up for work that day, but was acting strangely, staring into the distance, talking about things that didn't make sense. And then about 15 minutes into the work shift, Daniel left. And has not been seen since. On July 21st, A rancher found Daniel's Jeep rolled over and on its side in a ravine on his property. The airbags in the vehicle were deployed, and officials said evidence showed that Robinson was wearing his seatbelt at the time of the crash, but there was no sign of Daniel. Daniel's father, David Robinson, has relocated to Buckeye, Arizona to organize searches for his son, and there is a new one scheduled for this weekend, Saturday, 8 a.m. So, David, is there something specific that brought about this search on Saturday?
Thank you for having me on. After 21 weeks of searches, you can imagine back here behind me, this desert, I know a lot of it. We have a lot of volunteers that come in to with their drones and things like that. I've located some vertical mines that need to be checked. I also want to go over some of the areas that wasn't documented inside the police reports, like the well itself. They had the cadaver dolls into those to recheck those wells, and also the well that's north of where my son went missing. So, yes, it's a lot of areas out here that need to be cleared. We have right here behind me, it's going to be developed. So this month, they're breaking ground. So it kind of is a crucial time where we really need to get in here with law enforcement and clear this area so that we can move on to the next.
You know, it's really remarkable, David. When I talk to you, it feels like I'm talking to someone who has done this for a living for years. You are so entrenched in this project of finding Daniel. I want to know what it's like partnering with the actual police there, how much support you're getting, how much work they're doing, because you're seemingly spearheading it all.
Yes. I love my son. He's my baby boy. I had to protect him and work hard at it. As it go, I'm learning as I go. I'm not perfect, but I'm learning as I go. I'm driven by that love, that passion for my son. Whether law enforcement is here with me or not, I'm going to search for Daniel. I invited law enforcement in. Thank you. I'm grateful to Chief Hall saying they would be out this Saturday to help. I'd rather for them to be out of every searches. I've been doing this for 21 weeks, and they've always been invited. I had to use my own money to the generosity of the volunteers, their money, to conduct my searches. So I'm really grateful for the people that comes out and volunteer, but I definitely need law enforcement here also.
Where do the police say they think your son is?
Well, only theory I ever got from the Buckeye Police Department was on the 19th when the vehicle was recovered. They felt that my son wrecked his vehicle. He probably had a severe head injury. He shredded all his clothes off his body and just walked off in the desert, disappeared. One detective even think that he joined a monastery to become a monk. So other than that, outside of that, I don't know any theories or the new theories that the Buckeye Police Department may have, but I have a theory. And my theory is that something strange happened. My son would not leave his family. And at this point, 6 months later, didn't even talk to his mother. He loved his mother. He loved me. He loved his siblings and his family. So that's very odd for us.
We were seeing some pictures of the investigator that you had hired as well to do some of the additional legwork to investigate this mystery. David, we are sending you, all of our heartfelt wishes for a good result and good luck with the search this weekend. We hope you'll continue to update us, and you're certainly in our prayers.
Thank you. God bless you.
God bless you, David. Thank you. Keep Daniel in your prayers as well as they continue to look for him this weekend. Welcome back. Disease and old age have finally made Robert Durst untouchable for the crime that started it all. And by all, I mean decades of infamy as a super wealthy, super weird murder suspect and fugitive. Heir to a New York real estate fortune, Durst may well have done himself in with an offhand remark on a live microphone in a men's room. Yep. He died today. But not in his cell. He was in a California hospital less than 3 months into a life sentence, no parole, for the killing of his longtime friend and confidant, Susan Berman. Berman was shot in the back of the head in December of 2000, supposedly because she was threatening to tell the authorities what she knew about the disappearance of Durst's wife, Kathy. That was back in 1982, 40 years ago this month. In one of the last times that Kathy was ever seen publicly, she was treated at a hospital for bruises that she said came from her husband, Robert Durst. Neither she nor her remains have ever been found. But many years later, investigators had a new lead, and they decided to question Durst's friend, Susan. Before they got a chance to question Susan, they got a curious, weird note in the mail directing them to Berman's, quote, cadaver lying in a pool of blood. Okay, Durst's lawyers would concede, all right, it was Durst. It was our client who wrote that note. But now buckle up, because I haven't even gotten to the weird, grisliest part of this story. A few months after Susan's murder in California, Durst was arrested in Galveston, Texas, for the shooting death of a 71-year-old neighbor at a boarding house. Durst was on the lam, and he was disguised as a mute woman. I know, it's hard to make this stuff up, but Durst admitted to carving up the dead body of that neighbor, Morris Black, and then dumping all of his pieces into Galveston Bay. But Durst claims the shooting was in self-defense, and it happened in the course of a struggle. And if you can believe it, there is always a jury somewhere that will acquit someone, and that Texas jury acquitted Robert Durst. And for years after that disappearance, the disappearance and the apparent death of his wife, Kathy, it just remained unsolved, decade after decade. And then came a documentary called The Jinx, HBO docuseries, 2015. Robert Durst, like we had never heard him before. In the very last episode, the producers confronted Durst with that weird note, that cadaver note that I mentioned earlier, the one that police in California got just before they wanted to question Durst's friend, Susan Berman, about the disappearance of Durst's wife, Kathy. When the Jinx documentary shooting wrapped up, Durst stood up from his chair, he excused himself and said he needed to use the restroom, and he did, but he left his mic on. And this is what was recorded on his hot mic in the men's room. What the hell did I do? Killed them all, of course. One day before that finale aired, Durst was arrested and charged with the killing of Susan Berman. And 6 years of a COVID pandemic later, Durst was convicted. And 6 weeks after that, a grand jury on the other coast in New York indicted him for the murder of his wife, Kathy, from 40 years ago. And today, the New York prosecutor, Mimi Rocha, said this, quote, after 40 years spent seeking justice for her death, I know how upsetting this news must be for Kathleen Durst's family. We had hoped to allow them the opportunity to see Mr. Durst finally face charges for Kathleen's murder, because we know that all families never stop wanting closure, justice, and accountability. After a break, I want to talk about Robert Durst with a journalist who covered him for 20 years and testified against him in his murder trial. Stay with us. He was worth upwards of $200 million, but he died rail thin, a convicted murderer serving life, no parole. How did Robert Durst go off the rails so spectacularly? Lisa DiPaolo is a journalist who covered Durst for 20 years and ended up a witness for the prosecution in his murder trial. Lisa, I mean, wow, you're a perfect guest. Did you expect, especially having been a witness, that Robert Durst's life sentence would only last 3 months?
Look, Ashley, first of all, it's so great to see you again. And, you know, I was stunned by his death and saddened, too. I was saddened. I know you might say, why are you sad about Bobby Durst's death? Because we don't want to know. We want to know, what did he do with Kathy? Where's the body?
I think we're losing you a little bit. You know what? Gosh, we're losing you, Lisa. But what I think you're saying is that what's sad about this is that that man will take to his grave secrets about Kathy, the presumption is that That's 40 years after she disappeared, this family deserved something, a trial, to look them in the eye and have them, you know, answer the question, and that's the sad part.
Yes. And you know what, Ashley? I really had held out hope that toward the end that he might, before he died, tell where Kathy was.
And that would have been nice. You know, that really would have been nice before he passed away. And look at him. He was basically a shadow of his former self. He was always a thin guy anyway, but he looked like he was near death in his trial. Just quickly, I want to play a moment from that trial of Susan Berman's murder, because he took the stand in his own defense, which shocked a lot of people. But what an ornery guy. Have a look at this. Take a look.
Did you kill Susan Berman?
No.
Do you know who did?
No, I do not.
Okay. Wow. Well, that's you're not going to win friends and influence people like that. Lisa, what did the jury think of him? Like, was this an easy one for them?
For who?
For the jury.
I think so. And you know what? Here's an interesting thing. The jury in Los Angeles was very smart. They were a smart, educated jury. And when I asked John Lewin afterwards, the prosecutor, were you surprised
that they came back with a guilty verdict? He said no,
because they were smart.
And that's
where Bobby got away with murder. You know, he got on the stand. He said, I killed this guy. I chopped him up.
We did.
That was the Galveston. I still can't believe the Galveston jury said, okay, yeah, well, you cut up a man, you threw all 10 pieces into Galveston Bay, but we'll buy the fact that this was a a self-defense strike. Just quickly, I've only got a couple seconds left, Lisa, but the hot mic in the bathroom. Lots was made about that moment where he said, killed them all, of course. And then it came out in trial that the comments were edited. Were they edited so profusely that the jury discounted that, or did the hot mic really do him in?
Look, all filmmakers edit their stuff, but at the end of the day, he said that on a hot mic. He said, I killed them all, you know? So I don't think that he did. He said it.
Yeah, I feel for Kathy's family, because they could have had him on the stand and been able to at least look him in the eye and say, did you kill Kathy and where is she? But that's not going to happen. Lisa, we're going to get you a better signal and we're going to have you back. We've got the worst connection with you. You're sort of coming in and out, but I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us tonight. Thanks, Lisa.
But I hope that he can't do it now, but God, we'll never know where Kathy is.
Well, I'm crossing my fingers we will at some point. Sometimes miracles happen and people surface, and I'm hoping that happens for Kathy's family. Lisa DiPaolo, thank you so much. Okay, coming up, his parents wanted him to be a doctor. Casting directors wanted him to be white. How Cal Penn got the last laugh all the way to the White House. Plus his thoughts on the passing of a co-star named Bob Saget. That's next. Before Cal Penn's family made it to America, his grandparents marched with Gandhi in India. And those are pretty big shoes to fill for a kid raised in New Jersey. His parents wanted him to be a doctor. But after UCLA, Cal told them he got a part in a movie as a stoner. Oh, to be a fly on the wall for that conversation. But Cal made it big, really big, as like big, big star, you know, in movies like Harold and Kumar and TV shows like House and How I Met Your Mother. And speaking of House, he made it all the way to the biggest house, the White House, as an advisor in the Obama administration. But not before enduring a few decades of cliche casting directors who demanded he, quote, do the accent, you know, like Apu on The Simpsons. I did mention he was born in New Jersey, right? Cal's got a new book out called You Can't Be Serious that winds us through some of that uncomfortable stuff. Most people would have called it a day years ago, something Cal actually did. He quit. But a good thing for us, that didn't last long, and Cal joins me live. Now, this is a great book, Cal. Here I was thinking it was going to be joke after joke, and it's funny, but it's upsetting just to sort of see your journey, written in black and white like that. The first thing I want to ask you about is your name at the bottom of this book. It says Cal Penn, but your first name is Cal Penn. You changed it. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, of course, and good evening, Ashley. Thanks for having me. So coming up with a screen name is actually one of the early chapters in the book that I talk about, because the night that I came up with my screen name, it's a night that I think a lot of people can relate to. It was, I think, 2:00 in the morning. I was at UCLA hanging out with my college buddies, none of whom, by the way, were theater or film majors. They were all pursuing things that were way more practical. And they said, hey, why don't you come up with a screen name? Whoopi Goldberg's name isn't Whoopi Goldberg. And I said, it's not. I think it was my buddy Mark said, no, her real name's Karen Johnson. And then they went through this litany of names of actors who are household names, Chevy Chase, whose first name is Cornelius. And they said, why don't you think of a screen name, something that's a little more catchy? Maybe that'll help you get an agent, because I had been trying for about 3.5 years, couldn't get my foot in the door. And that same weekend, I was supposed to get new headshots taken. And I thought, let me come up with a catchy name. That's fine. Well, what should it be? And my first full name, as you mentioned, my first name is Kalpen, K-A-L-P-E-N. And Kalpen had been shortened to Cal the same way that Joseph becomes Joe. So a lot of those guys had called me Cal in the past. And they said, well, what about Cal Pacino? And just started off on these terrible puns for the next half hour. And then we ended up with Cal Penn, splitting my first name in half, and we joked, that adding a second N to Cal Penn would stand for not going to play a stereotypical cab driver. So it's sort of a good-natured, fun conversation that I tell in a lot more detail in the audiobook in the book. But the reason that I bring that up, and I'm glad you brought up the name on the cover too, is, I got an agent shortly thereafter. In fairness, I'll never know if it was the name or the new headshot or if I just delivered a great audition. But once you get a name as an actor, you can't really change it, because you kind of work consistently based on the name that you had. So that's the story about the name.
So the anecdotes that you write about in the book, I was like getting mad, as I was reading some of these, where you would show up, I just thought, I want to just go in there and shake these people. Like one casting director said, wait, you're not Latin? Oh, this isn't going to work out. And then another casting director had you pitted against a guy in brown face. Like, you're from the School of Acting at UCLA, and this guy in brown face is a white dude, and that was your competition. I could imagine quitting, too. What made you get back on the horse and say, I'm not going to quit, I'm actually going to do this?
That chapter, I think, that has a lot of those stories is literally called Auditioning to Be Latino, because I would go in, every actor, to be fair, also every actor goes in and you're told you're too tall, you're too short, you're too fat, you're too skinny. That's the gig. As an actor, you go on those auditions and you get rejected 99 out of 100 times. I think the thing that's tricky for a lot of women performers of color is that barrier to entry is a lot lower, because oftentimes we don't have the luxury of being too tall or too short or too fat or too skinny. And the reason that I tell all those stories now, obviously looking back from 2022, I love what I do as an actor. And being able to track that over the last 15, 20 years, I love the industry that I work in. I think it's wonderful that it's changed so much for artists and also for audiences. And I think the thing that kept me going, like many other artists, is this intangible of, how do you explain to somebody who doesn't do what we do for a living that you have to do it? It's that crazy part of you that makes mm-hmm. you an artist. I think athletes deal with this a lot too. Why do you think you get to pursue a career like that? It's like, well, I kind of have to. I got to shoot my shot and see if it works. And that's truly the American dream. I write a lot about my grandparents. I write a lot about,
it's in your blood,
I'm the product of a public school education. Sorry, what's that?
Oh, I said it's in your blood. You can't ignore it. If it's your passion, it's
passion. But the combo of the family story and the bravado of being from New Jersey, I think, is the combo that makes you keep going.
I have two things I need to ask you about, and I got like a minute and a half left. So the first thing is, one of the big secrets in the book that you reveal is that you've come out, and I can only imagine that conversation with your immigrant parents that want you to be a doctor. Oh, and I'm gay, and I have a boyfriend named Josh who I'm engaged to, and he's been my secret boyfriend for 11 years. How'd that go?
Well, so it wasn't a secret. I think one of the misnomers from the book, and naively, frankly, I just didn't think that chapter was the most interesting. But no, of course, my parents and my friends and coworkers and everyone has met Josh in the 11 years we've been together. And I'm so happy to share this weird third date story that's more funny than anything else. It's chapter 18 in the book about how our third date, which is what convinced me that the relationship wasn't going to move forward, was more about NASCAR and beers than anything else. So it's just one of those light, fun chapters that I'm happy to share with everybody.
Well, mazel on that one. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you. Bob Saget was such a surprise to so many of us. He was the narrator in How I Met Your Mother. You appeared in 10 episodes. I'm sure you guys didn't do a lot together, but you know, he seems to have affected so many people in your industry.
Yeah, who's not a Full House fan? I also loved Half Baked. I only met Bob Saget probably twice, you know, in my career. Once when we were doing a radio tour together in New York City, or rather at the same radio tour at the same time. And he was so incredibly kind and warm, and I didn't think he would know my background or my work at all. And so when I see people who knew him really well paying homage and really celebrating his life and his work, I you know, having just seen a little sliver of that made me smile and laugh on the occasion that I met him, my thoughts go out to his loved ones and his family.
The book is great. It's called You Can't Be Serious. It's available now anywhere you get books. Calpan, thank you. It's good to meet you this way. I hope we get to meet in person.
Thank you. Likewise.
Coming up, more details starting to emerge about what Cal was just talking about, the death of Bob Saget. Such a mystery. He's beloved by fans, but also by many colleagues who just called him one of the kindest guys in the business. When we come back, how he wound his way into our hearts on shows like Full House and his comedy specials. Before we say goodnight, we want to say goodbye to Bob Saget, the actor and comedian famous for his role on Full House and as host of America's Funniest Home Videos. He was found dead in his hotel room at the Ritz-Carlton in Orlando yesterday. The cause is still unknown, but police say it was not foul play and it wasn't drugs. He was 65 years old, but a young 65. John Stamos, who starred alongside Saget on Full House, tweeted this: "I am broken. I am gutted. I am in complete and utter shock. I will never ever have another friend like him. I love you so much, Bobby." Saget was in Florida performing stand-up. In fact, this was the last tweet he posted just hours before he was found. Love tonight's show. Appreciative audience. I'm happily addicted to this. You know what? Just over a week ago, Saget had this to say about Betty White's passing. He said, "I don't know what happens when we die, but if Betty White says you get to be with the love of your life, then I happily defer to Betty on this." Bob Saget, I don't even know how it happened, but everybody loved him, just loved him. Gone too soon at 65. And it's heartbreaking for a lot of people in the business, whether they met him or not. It's heartbreaking for a lot of his fans, too. That's us. That's it for us tonight. Thanks for being with us. Do appreciate it. We will see you right back here tomorrow night at 10 o'clock Eastern, 9 Central. In the meantime, just want to leave you with this image of a guy who just made us laugh.